This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We can say with confidence the next governor of the great state of Florida has already been governor. The fall gubernatorial contest is the race everyone figured it would be last spring. Governor Rick Scott, Republican, against former Republican governor, but now a Democrat, Charlie Crist. Crist gets the opponent who replaced him in the governor's mansion 4 years ago when he did not run.
But virtually every issue that matters to Florida's middle-class families, when it comes to taking even a single step to make it a little easier for Florida's families to pay the bills, Rick Scott has not been on our side. Don't boo, vote.
Crist easily beat challenger Nan Rich for the Democratic Party nomination during the primary election on Tuesday. Even though she won't be on the ticket, she pledged her support for Crist.
My motivation for running was what was happening to the state. For me, it was 16 years of Republican governors who hadn't shared my values. And I'm going to continue because I still believe in the importance of making sure that Rick Scott is no longer the governor of the state of Florida.
So we've got the top of the ticket now. It is governor versus governor, Scott versus Crist. Did you vote? Who'd you vote for? Who will you vote for this fall? If you didn't vote but could have voted, and a lot of you are out there, why not? Join us as we begin with politics here on the Florida Roundup, 1-800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet with the handle at WLRN, our live web chat, WLRN.org, again, here on the Florida Roundup. Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald is along with us in studio. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press joining us from the capital city Tallahassee. We will join Gary here momentarily. Sergio, does either Crist or Scott take any momentum out of this primary?
You know, I don't think so, because this race has been going on for some time already. It's, I think if you were a voter and seeing all the ads on TV, you would have thought, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll go to the polls on August 26th. And you arrive and you get there and it's Nan Rich and you go, who's that? You know, so really the campaign is still ongoing and it's been going, but I don't think any momentum per se is going to come out of it for either candidate.
Gary Fineout with the AP in Tallahassee. Where did Crist find the strength? Where did Scott see strength in terms of the state of Florida with their respective parties?
Well, I think the first thing, of course, as we look at is we look at the really overall bad turnout, and especially the bad turnout in Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, and Broward County. And Crist has tried to focus a lot of his energy on South Florida, realizing that they will be crucial for a potential victory. I think the question is whether or not we're going to have a bit of a repeat of 2010, which is where basically if Alex Sink had gotten strong turnout in South Florida, she'd be governor. Mm-hmm. Because in that election, of course, what happened is that there was really a surge of turnout in Republican-leaning counties. So I think the takeaway, of course, the Scott people are already taking away, look, you know, we got more votes in our primary than the Democrats did, even though they had a competitive primary. So for both sides, it's a recalibration and the question of whether or not they can gin up enthusiasm on each side and get their voters out there.
Yeah, let's talk about numbers here, Sergio and Gary. I mean, more Republicans voted in the primary than Democrats in the state of Florida, even though I believe it's true still, Sergio, there's more registered Democrats in the state of Florida than there are Republicans. The energizing level for Republicans has waned. Certainly it's not great for Republicans either, but we did see more GOPers turn out to nominate, again, Governor Scott. So I suppose on the Crist side, what is it that's got to be done here to get those Democrats to the polls, especially, as Gary mentions, in South Florida, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, where a significant chunk of those Democratic Florida voters are?
Well, Gary has hit it right on the political head because it's exactly true. In the three counties, the turnout was 14% in Miami-Dade, 12% in Palm Beach, and a dismal 10.8% in Broward, and that's pretty low. Now, granted, like I said, if you got to the voting booth, you didn't know who was voting, you know, who was running, and you saw this name, Nan Rich, the real contest is in November. But I'll borrow an analysis from our political writer, Mark Caputo, who looked at some of these numbers and found that, in essence, what happened in the primary was there were more Republican elections So there was more of a chance Republicans voting.
There's a longer ticket for GOP
exactly.
than Democrats.
So that could have been a, but really the real contest now is in November. And but as Gary says, I mean, they have got to get big numbers out of these three Democratic counties.
We spoke with our Public Insight Network contributors to find out why many typical voters didn't go to the polls on Tuesday. Sergio, as you mentioned, it was one in seven registered voters going to the polls in Miami-Dade County, one in 10 in Broward. Really dismal turnout here. So we spoke to members of our Public Insight Network to find out if they opted out of the primary election.
My name is Trevor. I am an MBA living in North Central Florida. I did not vote in the recent primary. I will vote in the general election. It's very simple. I am content with the likely outcomes for my party, and even some unexpected upside would not change my view toward the general election. Low voter turnout does not necessarily reflect disenchantment or indifference. I am engaged on political issues more so than political personalities, and it's not until the general election that issues come to the fore.
So issues coming to the fore for Trevor. Gary, I'm wondering, you know, as we've already seen the mudslinging happening, how much issue debate is actually anticipated between the Scott campaign and the Crist campaign versus personality bashing and the record keeping on flip-flopping for both candidates?
Well, I think we've already gotten a really good taste of it already. I think that I mean, I think there will be some discussion about some issues, but the fact of the matter is that the Scott campaign in 2010, Governor Scott in that campaign, if you recall, he really hit his opponents very, very hard. He hit both Bill McCollum in the Republican primary hard, and he hit Alex Sink pretty hard. I don't see any indication that they plan to change that. I mean, I'm sure that for the Scott campaign, part of the focus will be we've turned the economy around, we've created jobs, and then Crist campaign will counter that with, well, it was a national recession that caused the economic problems that I had to deal with, and you are not good for the environment, you are not good for education, and we need a change. So, I mean, I think we'll see that bubble forth at some point in time. I mean, they have at least pledged to at least do one debate, it appears.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get some element of that. But, I mean, your television is going to be awash with ads, and most of them are probably going to be negative.
Most expensive campaign, certainly nationwide this year, Sergio, has got to be this Florida governor's race. Where's the money coming from?
Well, it's coming from Scott's raising a lot himself. Mm-hmm. Remember last time he kind of put it and got his own wallet out. A lot of outside groups also participating because of the changes in law. You're seeing more and more of these outside third-party groups. But I think the money, you know, I remember last time they actually ran out of space on television to actually run all the ads. I see that coming. Like Gary says, expect a negative campaign. Get your shield out if you're not into the mudslinging. But it's going to be from here until November.
Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Round up here on WLRN, talking politics in our first segment at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Eric joins the conversation from Fort Lauderdale. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. Well, I was just going to say that I'm a registered Democrat, and I will be voting mostly on principle because I vote in every election, so I'm going to have to hold my nose and do it. I found it interesting that Charlie Crist appeared in Fort Lauderdale at Pier 66, no less, so, you know, a revolving restaurant, the one place in the city where sometimes you can face the left and sometimes you can face the right, but that was pretty nice. But I wondered about the significance of him being in Fort Lauderdale rather than being in Tampa, where he's from, or some other part of the state, and if his campaign, how nervous they are about getting people in the most consistently Democrat voting part of the state out to vote, and if it had anything to do with why he was showing up Broward on election.
We got the question. Thanks, Eric, from Fort Lauderdale. Sergio, location matters when it comes to election night. Optics matter.
No, Eric is making a very good point there, and I think the fact that he did a very good observation to be in Fort Lauderdale because he wanted to be here in the center of South Florida politics and the Democratic bastion here. So he needs these votes down here. That's really the reason why he wants to be down here.
And this was one of the places, Gary, that he could kind of, or Nan Rich could kind of go head-to-head. Nan Rich from Western Broward County, that you know, the Crist campaign could see how well, I suppose, a Democratic governor candidate in Charlie Crist is going to run against a longtime Democrat, to see what it's going to take to energize these voters on the left.
Well, he actually, I think... wound up doing pretty good. he did very well in Broward, and I think the issue is that, as we stated before, we have to stress again, the underperformance of Democrats in 2010 was a key reason that Alex Sink lost. If that hadn't happened, she'd be running for a second term right now. I think the situation is that. I think that both sides don't expect the wave that happened in 2010. We don't expect because remember in 2010 we had Marco Rubio at the top of the ticket.
Yep.
There's definitely, and it was that big Republican wave year. It was an opposition to the health care plan and everything like that. I don't think anybody expects that kind of Republican turnout. But the point is that the Scott campaign and the Republican Party, they have put in a tremendous amount of infrastructure. They've opened up all these field offices. They're doing all these phone calls and things of that nature. So they're going to try really hard to get their people out. Now, the question is, what kind of enthusiasm will Scott have on his side? He's got some interesting issues as well. I know that later in the show you're going to be talking about the education standards.
Yep.
I think the Common Core issue is a thing. And there are other things that he has to make sure that he solidifies his base. So, I mean, I think to me the question is unfortunately, are we going to have a very low turnout general election, and who is actually going to decide it?
Among those races that will be on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November is the race to become Florida's top prosecutor. The race here, Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi and former Department of Children and Family Secretary George Sheldon. Gary, does Sheldon's work at DCF under Governor Crist impact how voters may see him now?
I mean, I think the deal here is that George Sheldon is going to have I think he's going to have a difficult time getting a lot of people to know who he is. All the money he's raised so far, he had practically blown through by the time the primary was done.
He's raised a tenth of the money compared to the current sitting AG Bondi.
But more importantly, I mean, here's the problem. The problem for George Sheldon or for any other Democrat that's down ballot is your fate is now intertwined with Charlie Crist. If Charlie Crist and the Democrats have a good showing, then maybe you have a chance at knocking Bondi off. It's not that Attorney General Bondi also doesn't have a host of things that people could take aim at her over. The first of which is her position on the same-sex marriage,
right,
her position on medical marijuana. Sheldon has tried to emphasize his position in contrast with her on that. But at the end of the day, if nobody knows who he is, and she's been a constant presence in the last 4 years, including a lot of appearances on Fox News,
mm-hmm,
you know, I think the question is whether or not their people are just going to – they're going to stick with her because they know her.
Sergio, I'm wondering, with the Innocence Lost investigation from the Miami Herald, looking at more than 400 child deaths with children that had some contact with the Department of Children and Families, should we hear from Sheldon on this? Do we need to kind of understand his position with that agency and how that feeds into the job that he wants to do, which is the top prosecutor in the state?
I think the public is not going to make that direct connection. But I do agree with Gary that if Sheldon has empty pockets in the in his campaign, in terms of money, he's going to have an empty campaign. It's going to be a really tough battle.
Yeah, absolutely. Meantime, in the southern tip of Florida here, the endorsement from former presidential candidate Mitt Romney, Carlos Curbelo, won the Miami GOP nod in the 26th congressional primary. He beat a slate of Republican challengers, including former Congressman David Rivera, who ran under a big cloud of suspicion as he was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a campaign finance investigation just days before primary election. Curbelo now will face incumbent Democrat Joe Garcia. Sergio Bustos with the Herald, how do you see this shaking out?
Well, you want nasty? Look no further than this race. You got a young candidate in Carlos Curbelo, Miami-Dade school board member, GOP insider. Then you got a veteran with Congressman Joe Garcia, who's seen it all in a campaign. I mean, personal attacks. I mean, but this is a contest to really watch, and the national parties are watching as well. But this is a contest not for the politically squeamish. This will be
the
knocked
primary
out,
wasn't
dragged
for the politically
down. No,
squeamish
it was ugly.
At all. Yeah,
this will be a dragged down, dirty fight, a real close call, and you know, it's just going to be ugly. And keep in mind, the Keys voters did not vote in a majority for Curbelo. So maybe there's a fight there in the Keys somewhere, and maybe the nastiness will go south and not stay up here. But it'll be a very, very negative campaign.
Sergio mentions that there's some national implications here. Gary Finout, how's Tallahassee taking a look at this congressional race in South Florida?
Well, I think there's, you know, I think that there's a handful of races that, I mean, in the state of Florida that are going to be closely watched and monitored, including those outside Florida. And probably number one or 1A is the race in South Florida. Mm-hmm. And then the other big race is the North Florida contest between Gwen Graham, the daughter of former Governor Bob Graham, who is from Miami, and versus incumbent Steve Sutherland. I think the Graham-Sutherland race and I think the Garcia-Curbelo race are going to probably be the most intensive watched congressional races. I mean, because frankly, many of the other places in the state, the races aren't that, aren't expected to be close, aren't expected to be that competitive. We're going to be probably watching a little bit on that Treasure Coast race involving Murphy, U.S. Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy
Patrick
against
Murphy,
former Patrick Murphy against Carl Domino. That one probably is going to get some attention, although a lot of people think that the National Republicans have kind of written that race off, even though Murphy barely beat Alan West.
What, 2 years ago, right. So, Sergio, kind of what's at stake here in terms of the Florida delegation? If we have this, the race that we're watching up in the panhandle with the former governor's daughter and, of course, the nasty race down here between Curbelo and Garcia, is there a balance at risk potentially come, you know, early 2015 with the Florida delegation in Washington?
No, it still remains dominated by Republicans. I think what, like Gary says, what these two races will draw a lot of the national attention and a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's the other factor. That
again, more of that out-of-state money, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is money coming from a number of third-party groups, and it'll be a lot of mysterious money, too, because we won't know who the donors are exactly.
As obvious as this answer may be to this question, what's the money after? This out-of-state money that's coming in down to the tip of Florida for the 26th Congressional District, what's the interest that's behind it?
You know, in my many years of covering politics, because of that Supreme Court decision several years ago, which opened up the kind of the faucet on this, it's just there's so much money involved that it's got to flow somewhere. And if someone wants it and there's a competitive race, not, you know, both parties are going to go after it. And these mysterious groups, you know, that a lot of them do not have to name their donors, they are going to be dumping a lot of money in these because people want power. And there is a chance, you know, the House, at least the way Republicans see it, they could grab a few seats and maybe make a difference.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing here, Gary, is we do see all this outside money that can be coming into Florida for various reasons, but some of it may not have a direct interest necessarily in the 26th district or in the Panhandle district. Instead, it's all about trying to tip the balance of the 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Well, I think a lot of, I think as Sergio pointed out, I think a lot of outside groups want to be able to say that they played a role. And I think the thing about it is that what we should always remember is that the outside money comes in when they see a race that has reached a potential tipping point. I mean, the fact of the matter is that CD 26, the Garcia seat, was always seen as sort of as a swing seat. So it was kind of set up that way that, well, a Republican should win it. But, you know, as we saw, Representative Garcia was able to really go after Representative Rivera and his ethical problems 2 years ago. So I think the thinking is going into this year is like, well, Rivera's not the candidate now. So we won't have that issue to hold us back. So maybe we can easily flip it back and take it back. And I think that's what the deal is. I think it's the same with the Panhandle seat. I think while there's a big chunk of the Panhandle seat that is in fact red Republican, there's also a chunk of it that's blue Democrat.
Yeah.
That's the state capital, and I think people look at the numbers and they say that's a winnable seat, and I think that influences a lot of that thinking. Is like, where can I put my money at play and I will win a seat?
Perhaps another ballot issue that's going to draw in some outside money and certainly plenty of interest is Amendment 2. two guys. Of course, this is the effort to allow legalized medical marijuana in the state of Florida. It certainly could impact turnout here on the Florida Roundup. Steve is joining the conversation from Key West regarding Amendment 2. Steve, go ahead.
Well, you guys were talking about how you weren't necessarily expecting a big turnout or questioning the size of the turnout. And from what I've heard from other sources is it's anticipated that this could be one of the larger turnouts, especially because of Amendment 2. And the reason I state that is because of the people for and against. It's a very personal issue for a lot of people. And they are going to want to come out and either support, well, actually just support their position on this.
Steve from Key West, we got it. So Amendment 2, driving voter engagement, Gary Fineout. What say you out of Tallahassee?
Well, I think that the initial belief was that it was going to possibly be a game changer in terms of turnout. I think the plain answer is if you see polls that indicate that it's going to possibly pass with 80% of the vote, notwithstanding an attempt to defeat it, will that affect someone's psychology? Mm-hmm. In other words, I think the thinking is if you look at that issue and you say it's going to easily pass, I don't need to go out and vote on that particular issue, will you still be motivated? I mean, I'm not saying that things couldn't change in the next 2 months. I mean, but the fact of the matter is to defeat the amendment or to pass the amendment, which of course has to pass by 60%. You're talking about probably having a substantial amount of resources, as we were just talking about. There's going to be all these gubernatorial ads. There's going to be all these congressional ads, and so to try to get that message out there. I'm not saying that people aren't going to be are not going to know about it. I'm just questioning whether or not there's going to be everyone's going to say, well, it's going to pass.
Sure.
So
if it's enough of a motivating factor to get off the couch and go to the polls. Absolutely. Yeah. Sergio, go ahead.
Tom, you're talking about medical marijuana. So underlying medical marijuana, it's hard to be against something that could help people that are on their deathbed. Usually it's these children that are in these horrific situations. You know, and I think everyone's heart goes out to these parents helping them out. Now, if it were just marijuana legalized, as it is in a couple states, now you're talking major interest, big money, but it's medical marijuana. And I think, again, it will be one of those that the polls show it's 80%, like Gary says. I mean, I'm not sure that's really going to drive the traffic to the polls.
It may not, but instead it may drive that 20% against it to the polls, and then you tip the balance of the 60% of actually showing up in order to get the amendment actually approved on Election Day. Certainly one to watch. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press, thanks so much for your thoughts. Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald will continue. So will we. Still to come, a whopper of a deal. Miami's Burger King buys a Canadian fast food chain, moves north of the border where taxes are lower, so the king gets a new kingdom. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 2 years ago, as South Florida was still digging out of the housing collapse and recession, Fort Lauderdale's Economic Development Agency, the Greater Fort Lauderdale Alliance, launched a marketing campaign with a uniquely Florida selling point.
Why have so many companies relocated to Greater Fort Lauderdale?
No state income tax. It doesn't get any better than that.
Greater Fort Lauderdale. Life less taxing.
Hey, it's not what you make. It's what you keep.
It's not much you make. It's what you keep. South Florida recognizes a competitive advantage when it sees one. Zero state income taxes. Now, this week, a company that has called Miami home for more than a half century announced it was moving its parent corporate headquarters to Canada. Burger King will buy Canadian coffee and donut chain Tim Hortons. The combined HQ will be in Canada, where the corporate tax rate is less than half what it is here in the United States. But Burger King was insistent the deal is not about escaping U.S. corporate federal income taxes. The Burger King brand will continue to be run out of Miami. Yet this move caused plenty of outrage, primarily on social media, but elsewhere as well. Do you think this is a tax dodge? Will you stop eating at Burger King? Will you sell the stock if you own shares of BKW? Let us know at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or on Twitter using the call sign at WLRN. Joining us for the conversation, Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald and Al Lewis, the South Florida Business Journal editor, along with this as well. Al, why do you think so many people are outraged by this?
We've had a financial crisis that has hollowed out the middle class, left many people unemployed, left many people underemployed. A lot of people blame our largest corporations for this crisis. We're still recovering from it. There's a lot of talk about how the economy is better, but it isn't better for everyone. And to see our largest companies moving offshore and not addressing the fact that we have an $18 trillion national debt is it angers people.
But does Burger King have an obligation to stay in the United States if it has an opportunity to grow its business in other locations?
Well, it certainly has no legal obligation. We can argue about whether or not it has any kind of moral obligation. It was built on the American consumer, despite the fact that now most of its opportunity does lie overseas. I think that's up to consumers to decide.
And what do you mean by up to consumers to decide?
Well, if consumers don't like this, they shouldn't shop there, right? That's basically what it comes down to, consumer choice. And I think that they're taking a risk with their brand. Not only was there a lot of outrage on social media, but you had two U.S. senators chiming in. Okay, granted, it's an election cycle. But, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, the senator there, Democrat, was calling for a boycott. Dick Durbin of Illinois, also a Democrat, was urging people to sign a petition. You know, people have short memories, so I don't know how far this is going to go. But the outrage is palpable, and it's there. And Burger King's response to it has been pretty much, we don't care.
I will point out that Senator Durbin is a minority leader in the U.S. Senate. His home state also happens to be home to McDonald's, a key competitor of Burger King. And as far as I know, McDonald's is staying headquartered in the United States.
Sure, and Ohio has Wendy's.
That's right.
Never mind. You know, senators are grandstanding. Let's face it.
Well, they are.
But it doesn't help your brand to have U.S. senators, whether they're grandstanding or whatever their motivations may be, to say this.
It certainly doesn't. But the competitive advantage of lower taxes is something that municipalities have used consistently in the United States. We played the marketing bit from Fort Lauderdale, life less taxing. That certainly is the case not only in Fort Lauderdale, but all of Florida with no state income tax. And state economic development folks will try to leverage that with companies in New York, companies in California, companies in high tax areas, trying to get them to either open up branches here or maybe move here entirely to the detriment of those locations they're moving from.
You know, it's a little bit different when you look at economic development challenges state to state than it is from country to country. You know, Chiquita Brands moved from Ohio to North Carolina, and people were very upset about that. But guess what? It's still in the United States. Now, this goes to show you how loyal they are and how what a folly it is to even play this economic development game. They're talking about moving to Ireland.
Where their taxes are lower.
And I got to tell you, companies that don't have a consumer presence can probably do this without anyone complaining about it. Most of these tax inversion deals have happened without anyone complaining about it. In the case of Walgreens, they decided not to do it because there were so many complaints against it. So they're taking a risk with their brand by moving offshore. I think consumers have a short memory. I think here in America, we love to get mad and tweet about it. And then, you know, we're going to smoke some of that medical marijuana. It's going to be midnight. And Burger King drive-thru is going to be the only thing open, right? We're going to go.
Al Lewis with the South Florida Business Journal. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, talking about Burger King's cross-border merger, making a run for the border, the northern border this time around. Jonathan joining the conversation from Miami Beach. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Thank you. Interesting topic. You know, from my standpoint, I tend to lean more liberal in my politics, but this particularly doesn't really disturb me. You know, directors, officers of these companies, they owe duty to their shareholders to maximize that bottom line. And if this is one way of doing it and it's legal, you know, for certain politicians and to complain about it, it's really a lot of hot air.
You going to stop shopping or eating at Burger King, Jonathan?
No, not at all. I mean, like you said, people have a short memory. And at the end of the day, they're doing this because it's legal and it maximizes shareholder return. So it really is not much for us to complain about. If really the politicians in D.C. got together and started finally thinking of a solution as to, you know, issues regarding individual tax rates as well as corporate tax rates, then, you know, that's the conversation you have to start having now and stop complaining on a one-off basis
that this is inappropriate.
Jonathan from Miami Beach, thanks for the thoughts, the calls, and the comments. Al, even the president has talked about this tax inversion strategy where a U.S. corporation will go overseas and domicile in a location with a lower federal corporate tax rate. He's decried it, but yet there doesn't seem to be much political support beyond the grandstanding to actually crack open the tax code and address it in a real way.
I hope these politicians are talking to themselves, because the real problem is the U.S. tax code. You know, if you don't want America's largest companies and best brands to move offshore, don't have a tax code that encourages them to do just that. And unfortunately, that's what we have. Everyone agrees that's what we have. Nobody wants to fix it, because then we open up the sticky wicket of tax reform. And, well, we have a lot of cowardly people in Washington whose main concern is getting reelected, not dealing with the complexities of tax reform.
Al Lewis with the South Florida Business Journal. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup, talking about Burger King's move north of the border. Sergio Bustos, you for the Miami Herald, you've been in South Florida for a long time. Burger King dates back to the 1950s. It's no longer will be corporate headquartered down here in South Florida. Is this a blow to the Miami corporate brand?
You know, what's interesting about this is it's just too easy to poke fun at this, because it's like, you know, Burger King wants it their way. You know, it's a whopper of a
great
Facebook entry they put that they said this has nothing to do with taxes. I think that was a stretch. I think it's just a more PR disaster for them. I mean, I don't know. The social media now, it's pretty nasty, and it's all around that people are like, you know, come on, give me a break.
But years ago, generation or so ago, I mean, Burger King was a significant corporate pillar in this community. It was a big supporter of local charities in a big way. It has maybe reduced its corporate presence in Miami, as it's been under private ownership, although it's publicly traded, but a private equity fund owns a majority of the company.
And I think that's the story around all America. I mean, a lot of these equity firms have bought up companies. This is just a base one. They have an office here, but
that's maybe
they don't have that same philanthropic or community connection that they may have had in the past. It remains to be seen. I think Burger King has promised to obviously stay in Miami, but also maybe reach out more to the community in terms of philanthropic events. But we'll see.
Al Lewis, does this trend continue? Burger King is perhaps the highest profile consumer company now to tax inversion of the week. But yeah,
certainly,
your sense is the pipeline could be full.
Well, Burger King has gotten more blowback on this than I've seen. I mean, Walgreens backed off because it got blowback, but I don't remember it being this nasty. I mean, some of the comments that you see on Twitter and Facebook, you can't even say on the radio, right?
Well, in the Walgreens deal, you know, they do significant business with the federal government through their pharmacy operations and selling prescription drugs to folks that may have Medicare, Medicaid, and some other, you know, government payer plans.
Right. But, I mean, our country has been taken over by large corporations that are run by international and global interests that don't really have a stake here. You know, McDonald's has the Ronald McDonald House, right? They take care of sick children. I mean, they've been very good about lots of controversies at McDonald's, don't get me wrong, but they've been very good about being involved in the communities that they serve. Many big cities have a Ronald McDonald House. Mm-hmm. They do charities and they do things. And, you know, you can be mad at the fact that they don't pay people quite enough and all, you know, the poisons they put in their food. We can go on and on and on. But they're here, and I think people appreciate that. And I think increasingly, you know, we get these swells of Buy American, right? As long as the economy stays the way it is, where people aren't getting what they think is a fair break, there's going to be more and more pressure on companies to serve this country and to serve the people in it. Why should I buy a burger from Burger King when I can buy one from Wendy's, right? And they're based here. And probably, I wasn't eating that many Burger King burgers anyway. They've lost a lot of their U.S. customers. The best thing they got going besides this thing is their chicken fries.
Chicken fries right now still made in America at this point, as far as we know.
I think they're imported from China, and they've had some issues with that too. But
well, if you're a Burger King shareholder, though, the shareholders are rejoicing. I mean, this had a significant pop in the
price
of
Burger King
shares.
Who those shareholders are. 70% of it is owned by 3G Capital,
which is a
Brazilian-owned hedge fund. So yeah, the guys in Brazil are happy. You know, it's not a widely held stock beyond that. So, you know,
Burger King stays in Miami. Corporate headquarters moves to Canada if this deal is consummated. We still have plenty more Florida Roundup to come, and still on the program, opting out of Florida state education standards. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. The sound of protesters this week from the Naples News outside the Lee County School Board meeting this week, calling for the county to end state-mandated testing. And the board agreed, ultimately voting 3-2, to have Lee County public school kids skip tests of Florida's new state education standards. Lee County Superintendent Nancy Graham expressed her worries about what's next.
So I'm very concerned that this will hurt children. Teachers will have no idea where to go, because if we opt out, are we opting out of the standards? Are we just opting out of the assessments? Are we going to pick and choose? Are we no longer going to do advanced placement? Do we just close our ACE programs and our IB programs? You're talking about a lot of elements that nobody's really had time to think about.
The questions continue even today. Public school students in Fort Myers, in Cape Coral, and Bonita Springs, the first in Florida who will not participate in the state-mandated testing for the Florida standards. That's what the state's version of Common Core is called. Don't call it Common Core. Call it Florida Standards. Do you support these types of state-required tests? Have you taken them? Have your kids taken them in years past? Do you support these Florida state standards? Let us know by joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN on Twitter, at WLRN. Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald continues with us. Christina Vega covering education for the Herald also along, and John O'Connor covering education for State Impact and WLRN. John, let's begin. First of all, can public school districts opt out of these tests and say, no thanks, not going to give them?
No. State law is pretty clear on this. The Florida School Boards Association put out a document. They've got a meeting coming up next week, and this document is a memo laying out all the ways that this decision conflicts with state law. Basically, the bottom line is state law says school districts must participate in the statewide testing program.
And so what's at risk for Lee County students, for teachers, and for administrators by not taking these tests?
Potentially, there's a lot of money at risk here. There's state funding for school. The funding for schools flows through the state, and so potentially the state could shut off that spigot. Mm-hmm. There's also federal money, Title I funds that are at stake here. They also flow through the state. The State Department of Education or lawmakers could either one could decide to cut off that funding. There's lots of other consequences here.
Even graduation, kids are technically able to graduate from school.
Graduation
from high school.
Athletics is at stake as well.
If a third grader can move on to fourth grader, if a 12th grader can get a high school diploma. I mean, these are all questions that the Lee County School Board has yet to answer, and state school officials have yet to really decide how this is going to fall out.
Absolutely. And actually, there's some news this morning from Lee County that the board member who cast the deciding vote has now asked for a meeting next week to reconsider that vote. So they may actually change that decision very quickly.
Christina Vega, kind of living life backwards maybe a little bit in Lee County, at least in regards to some buyer regret, perhaps. Are there other districts in the state of Florida? I mean, certainly there's a lot of controversy around Common Core. Don't call them Common Core. It's Florida standards. But Lee County, really, is it out on its own here, or could other districts perhaps follow?
When you talk to parents who are opposed to this, what they call overtesting, a lot of them seem to be very empowered by this action. And speaking to district officials here in Miami-Dade, they say in no uncertain terms that this is illegal. But there are tons of Facebook groups and social media groups that have sprung out in Miami-Dade particularly to discuss this issue, of parents who feel kind of emboldened. And there was talk about asking board members to try to get items on the next board agenda to discuss this. So we'll see. The district, though, has been pretty non-equivocal about saying that this is illegal.
And what for those who are supportive of Lee County's action this week, what is it that they're supportive of? In other words, is it the standards that are being tested? Is it the tests Is it standardized tests in general? Is it the leverage that the tests have on graduation, on teacher pay, on administrator pay? Where is it, John, Christina, either of you, understanding this issue of where the controversy, where the opposition lies?
I'll say there's a spectrum of opposition. It ranges from folks who don't like the tests, that feel like these tests put undue pressure on the kids. The broader opposition is to then the all of the consequences tied to the results of tests, from teacher pay, teacher evaluations, whether kids graduate or move on to another grade. And then probably the broadest opposition would be that this is part of a larger scheme to privatize public education, is the concern, or, you know, kind of corporatize public education. And so that these test results are a way to kind of attach data to every student and then, you know, treat kids like widgets.
Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald. This is the singular, I think it's fair to say, issue that we've been able to identify in the governor's race. There's been a lot of personality bashing, some position bashing, but we do know that Governor Scott and former Governor Crist have engaged on this education issue.
I think this is the one issue where you'll see a very, very healthy debate between the two. Each one is trying to outspend the other, which is interesting.
To spend more on education.
To spend more on per pupil spending. You know, they're trying to make it, they're trying to make themselves or frame themselves as the education governor. And so expect a lot on this issue in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, Rick Scott this week said that he wanted a review of Florida's new education standards. He wants an independent committee to look into these benchmarks. So he's called on the Department of Education to lead what he calls a, quote, thorough investigation of all standardized tests, end quote. Christina Vega with the Miami Herald. This isn't just a review of Florida standards. All standardized tests, pretty blanket investigation that the governor's calling for here.
Yeah, we'll see, you know, what actually happens, because this is an election season, and they're calling for lots of different things. So.
But this comes, of course, after the controversy of Common Core, and then in February of this year, they changed, policymakers changed Common Core in Florida to the Florida standards, arguably 98% similarity between Florida standards and Common Core. This is, to some degree, about semantics, some would argue. But what is the position, I suppose, on education that you feel, John, that Governor Scott is trying to carve out just in the past few weeks?
Well, first of all, let's point out his language that he used was he wants to review every standardized test that school districts are requiring their students to take. So he's not talking about the state test, and the state test is what drives most of the complaints from parents, from students, from educators. On the Common Core issue, he's walking a fine line here because given the option, he'd probably do what Bobby Jindal did in Louisiana and come out and oppose Common Core. It's good politics for him. But he has Jeb Bush, and he has a Republican institution here in Florida that has a lot at stake in the standards, and they can't back off the standards. And so this is the strategy seems to have been over the last year or so to let Common Core opponents exhaust themselves in continual outrage, all the while not really changing anything and hope that they go away. They're not going to.
It hasn't gone away. Absolutely. I mean, look at the results out of Lee County just this week. For instance, Sergio, the positions that the two gentlemen running for the highest office in the state that are carving out, as you mentioned, it's about spending money. And we've heard from the governor about adding per student funding to an all-time high if he's reelected. He's talked about an additional $10 million in school safety funding, doubling the investment in digital learning initiatives to spend $80 million in state money along those lines. We haven't heard such specifics yet from Governor Crist.
No, he went on a bus tour a couple weeks ago.
And, a school bus tour.
A school bus tour. No less. Yeah. Got on a yellow school bus, got into a little fender bender, ran into a horrific rainstorm in Miami. Mm. But there was nothing on the agenda laying out the big policy, which I think is a mistake. I think we were expecting it, so we went on the tour.
Yeah.
Came away empty-handed there. But he's going to have to lay out exactly what he wants to do, because it's one of those issues, too, that there's several constituencies here. And one of them, of course, is parents, mm-hmm. like myself, school children. The other one is teachers.
Yeah.
The teachers' union is very strong. So they're going to want to hear a message, too.
Right.
So it's a fine line for them both to walk. But expect a lot on this subject between now and November.
Hopefully a lot more particulars. And at its core, the issue of education, the issue of standardized testing here, guys, is all about local control versus federal government control, right? I mean, that's the core, I suppose, of the Common Core argument to some degree. There's another fight between the state and the feds over testing students learning the English language. State law here in Florida currently allows students learning English, John, what, 2 years before the annual test scores or the state tests have to be included in the school performance?
Yeah, that law was passed this spring.
In the meantime, you've got the U.S. Department of Education coming forward saying, no, Florida's wrong. All students ought to be tested equally, and all of those test scores should be accounted equally. So on Wednesday, Miami-Dade School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, Florida Education Secretary Pam Stewart, and Governor Rick Scott came together as a trio and argued against those federal rules.
We believe federal officials haven't properly scrutinized their decision. The commissioner will detail in her letter that we're providing federal officials 30 days to reverse course and end their overreach. If they refuse, we will begin reviewing every legal option that is available to us.
Why is this a state issue, John? Why is this issue about the accountability of students learning English into school grade performance a controversy between Tallahassee, essentially, and Washington?
Well, this stems from the No Child Left Behind law. The law expired. Congress has not done anything with it yet, so it's just kind of hanging out there, which means the rules still apply. And so the Federal Department of Education allowed states to make some proposals of how they were going to watch their schools, keep the schools accountable, and they give a waiver to the states from those rules. That's what's at stake here, is that Florida, under the terms of the waiver, the State Board of Education said, okay, we'll test these English language learner students after a year, and we'll count their results, the percentage of students who can pass the test. It's what's known as proficiency. Mm-hmm. We'll count those results in the accountability system. Educators and lawmakers came back later and said, look, we don't like that. We think the kids really need 2 years. Our experience in the school shows that it really takes 2 years before these kids can start to understanding and speak English. And so they passed the law this spring, and the federal government is saying, that's not acceptable to us, and your waiver might be at stake here.
Christina, here in South Florida, clearly there's plenty of diversity in the classroom. There are dozens of languages in some cases that can be spoken. What's at stake?
It's a particular issue here in Miami-Dade because there are about 70,000 students who are learning English as a second language. And what would happen under the terms of this waiver, if the state and the feds can't come to an agreement, basically all of these student scores will have to count, and also basically all of the schools in Florida will be deemed as failing, and they'll have to fall back on these very oppressive measures about how they can spend their money and structuring staff at the schools, that sort of thing. So you have a huge population down here that this affects. And Miami-Dade cited their own data in saying that in the second year of English language instruction, there are 28 percentage points difference in the number of students who are at proficiency level. So that's why they're really fighting for this 2 years.
I want to get back real quick just to the impact. You're talking about a number of schools failing if the federal rules are followed or forced to follow here in Florida. What's the result of that? What's the result of those failures?
Again, they would lose some of their autonomy in funding, and also the schools themselves might be forced to restructure their staffs, bring in whole new teaching and leadership staffs.
Christina Vega covering education for the Miami Herald, John O'Connor covering education for State Impact Florida, as well as WLRN, Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald covering all things political and otherwise. Thanks so much to the three of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup today. Thanks as well to all the callers. And finally, here on the Roundup, this program, next week it will mark 1 year since Diana Nyad came ashore in Key West, completing her historic swim across the Florida Straits from Cuba to Key West. So now, 1 year later, she's returning to both islands to celebrate. Nancy Kleiner spoke to her this week.
When Diana Nyad reached the beach in Key West last year, she says she was in a physical, mental, and emotional daze. She didn't even have a chance to thank her team.
But Monday on that beach, because I didn't get to that day, I didn't get to turn around. I didn't have the presence of mind or the energy to turn around and reach out. I just was whisked off. And this is my chance Monday in that very place to say to them directly and cry with them.
Over the weekend, Nyad and 10 members of her crew will be in Cuba for celebrations there. On Monday, they'll be back in Key West. The city is unveiling a plaque honoring Nyad at Smathers Beach. That's the spot where she stepped ashore on Labor Day last year, after almost 53 hours in the water. The swim was Nyad's fifth attempt at the crossing.
And all those failures were public, and they were crushing.
But Nyad said she knew each time that she would try again.
Let's put it this way. I'm more proud of not giving up on it than I am of having actually made it.
And she did make it. WLRN's Nan Klinger reporting from Key West with long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad celebrating 1 year after that historic swim across the Florida Straits from Cuba to Key West. Congratulations. That is the Florida Roundup for today. Thanks again to all of our guests and callers and participants. The program is produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Steph Farrow, and Julia Duba. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Executive producer, Peter J. Merritt. Technical supervisor keeping the trains running on time, Paul Leary. Thank you, Paul. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.